Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. The federal health program called Medicare was founded in 1965 and now provides health coverage for some 41 million Americans, almost everyone age 65 or older, and also some 6 million younger adults with permanent disabilities. Like Social Security, Medicare could be called a social insurance program that provides health coverage regardless of income or health status. After years of debate, last year Congress passed a Medicare Modernization Act, which includes a new prescription drug benefit. The features of this new benefit are, shall we say, a bit complicated. Adding to the complication, this is a presidential election year, and it's safe to say the health policies of the two leading candidates differ in major ways. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about Medicare issues in the 2004 presidential campaign with a guest who has been looking at Medicare and related issues for a very long time. Richard Kaplan is a professor in the College of Law at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. An internationally recognized expert on U.S. taxation and tax policy, he has lectured in these areas on three continents, testified before the U.S. Congress on several occasions, and written course books on income taxation and international taxation. Professor Kaplan developed one of the first law school courses on elder law also, and has served as faculty advisor for the Elder Law Journal since its inception in 1993. He has also been recognized with the Campus Award for Excellent in Graduate and Professional Teaching at the University of Illinois, and we're glad to have him with us this morning to discuss Medicare. If you would like to join us, this is a call-in show. We welcome your questions on these topics. All you have to do is pick up the telephone, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, if you're listening on the air, and anywhere else in the continental U.S., in fact, if you're listening online. The toll-free line is 800-222-9455. Your questions are welcome. We also quickly want to mention, and I'll probably do this a couple more times, that next Tuesday, October 5th at 7 p.m., WILL-TV and AM580 will air a 60-minute live discussion entitled Electing Healthcare, and the focus is essentially on the Bush and Kerry campaign's proposals for healthcare and how those should be analyzed, essentially looking at three particular areas of their proposals: medical malpractice, Medicare and Medicaid, and the uninsured and access to health care. And our guest Richard Kaplan will be one of the analysts for that program next Tuesday at 7. And thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Jack.
Well, I have not been able to figure out the details exactly of this new Medicare law, so you can count on me to ask some really basic questions here. The fact is the new prescription drug benefit is basically a new option. I think option is the operative word for those in the Medicare program.
That's exactly right. In fact, to make it even more complicated, it comes in two very different stages, one of which is already in effect right now. That is, people may choose, as you point out, to buy one of these drug discount cards. Mm-hmm. There are some 73 that are authorized. They do not cover the same drugs. They are not accepted necessarily at the same pharmacies, and they offer very different discounts. But there are a number of packages that people can choose to get. Their prices range from zero a year to as much as $30 a year. And it's literally one of those things where the best way to figure out which program you want is to bring your laptop into your medicine cabinet and see which drugs are covered and to what extent and for what prices. Even if you go through that drill, which many people are not inclined to do, that entire program vanishes in a little more than 15 months. Mm-hmm. The advertised major Medicare prescription drug benefit that is really the focus of last year's legislation doesn't take effect until January of 2006. But even then, that will be an optional program, as you suggest, because there are some serious premiums that go with that. The price hasn't been set yet, but the best estimate is that it'll be about $35 per month. So that's about $420 a year, and that doesn't include an annual deductible, which will be at least $250. So that unless people have drug expenses of over $670, there's really no reason to get it. In addition, some three out of four people on Medicare already have drug coverage, either through Medicaid for poor people, through employer-provided plans for retirees, through managed care arrangements that they are already in that typically provide some degree of prescription drug coverage, or through private Medigap policies. So among other things they'll need to do is compare the new Medicare prescription drug plan, not in the abstract, but compared to what they already have, at least for the 76% of older people who have some degree of drug coverage now. For the 24% who have none, it's a somewhat easier decision since they're writing on a blank slate, but even then, it's completely voluntary.
Okay. And what does the benefit cover in terms of prescription drugs? Are there also, complicated details in terms of coverage?
The Medicare prescription drug benefit for the year 2006 is different than any other prescription drug benefit that exists literally in the world of healthcare, not just in the United States, but anywhere else. So it purports to cover all medications. It covers any quantities and any amounts of dosages. And instead, it has several distinct layers or tiers that are based on how much you spend cumulatively. So as I mentioned, the first tier is a $250 annual deductible where they don't cover anything. And then the next $2,000 of costs, the Medicare plan will pick up 75% of the cost, and people are paying 25%, a so-called 25-75 split. That's not terribly unusual. What's unusual is that that stops when a person's annual drug expenses reach $2,250, that is $2,250, mm-hmm. and then you get into this no-coverage zone, sometimes called a donut hole, where for the next $2,850, Medicare pays zero. Then if you have enough drug expenses to get beyond that, and now we're talking about drug expenses of more than $5,100 per year, then you reach what might be a sort of nirvana in the sense that the government will now pick up 95% of the benefit. This is the so-called catastrophic care plan, and you only pay 5%. And there is no cap at that. But most Americans, including most older people, do not run up $5,100 of annual drug expenses. That, of course, can change depending on what medications they get on and which new drugs come out. But right now, most people are going to be in that under $5,100, and a fair number will be in this donut hole or coverage gap where they are getting no coverage. And even then, those folks have to keep a running tab as to how much they spent to know when they have gotten out of the donut hole. So this is a plan, an annual deductible, a copay of 75% with the government paying that and the 25% the individual's paying, then this coverage gap. And there is no counterpart in Blue Cross, in Blue Shield, in Medigap, or anything like that. A lot of plans have deductibles. A lot of them have cost sharing. A lot of them actually have caps beyond which there are no further benefits. But none of them have this gap in the middle. That's a unique concept that came up, that Congress came up with, primarily because they wanted to make the plan appeal to as many people as possible, but still stay within a certain cost estimate and at the same time provide catastrophic care coverage for people who really, really need it. The result of these disparate means or these disparate objectives is this very odd benefit. And what makes it even stranger then is the point that you led with is if you don't like it, if you find it confusing, you don't have to do this at all, which raises a very significant issue of so-called adverse selection, namely who is most likely to buy into this plan. It's probably going to be people who anticipate being fairly heavy users of pharmaceuticals, mm-hmm. because otherwise it's not really going to pay. And then that raises costs, questions about is this going to end up costing a great deal more than even the government now anticipates.
So by de facto, it could become the catastrophic drug coverage of choice for people.
With most people who would be needing to pay $5,100, it's hard to imagine an alternative package that's going to do as well. But that's a real minority of people. It depends on which survey and estimates you're looking at. But at most, it's about 8 to 9%. So that's really a very small minority of Medicare enrollees who have those sorts of heavy drug expenditures. That could certainly change over time as new pharmaceuticals become developed and new prices become attached to them. But for the great bulk of older people who either have some drug coverage or do not, but do not anticipate having those kind of drug expenses, it's really a tough mathematical projection as to whether this is worth getting involved with. Just to give you one window on that, and this is only dealing with the drug discount cards because the other benefit hasn't even begun a sign-up period, that they anticipated a little over 4.5 million people of the poorest elderly would sign up for these drug discount cards, and only about 25% have done so, in part because it's complicated and it's confusing in terms of which medications are covered and at which pharmacies.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do the drug cards actually work? I mean, do they somehow – I mean, who handles the transactions with Medicare then?
That's an interesting point because Medicare really is not involved with the drug discount cards except at the front end by approving the program. That is, they make sure that there's a certain number of drugs in certain broad categories that are covered and that within that, that there are certain solvency requirements that have been met. But after that, Medicare really has no financing role. The cards are self-paid, that is, the people pay their own subscription fee, and then they use it as a qualifying pharmacy. And if the drug would otherwise cost $100 a month, they show the card and they can get it for basically $80 a month, depending on the specific card. Now, for low-income elderly who are below the poverty line, they get cards that are preloaded with $600 of money that Medicare put into the card, and they can then roll that down like you would an ATM and use that. But that's the extent of Medicare's financing, is basically funding those cards for low-income elderly. And as I say, as bizarre and confusing as this arrangement is, everything I've said about that, you throw out the window in 2006, whereas there is a totally different approach, presumably going to be run actually by private insurance companies with Medicare doing some of the underwriting, but it won't be involving the Medicare bureaucracy as such. A lot of those details haven't been worked out. That's one of the reasons that they didn't implement that drug benefit plan immediately, because they knew it was going to take a while to get up to speed. Mm-hmm. The drug discount cards were easier to move out, to roll out right away, and even then that took about 6 months because a number of major pharmaceutical suppliers, Pfizer and GD Searle, had drug discount cards of their own. So the basic mechanics and a lot of the infrastructure was already out there.
We're talking this morning with Richard Kaplan, professor at the College of Law at the University of Illinois, about Medicare issues in the 2004 presidential campaign and talking about the new Medicare law and some of the details. We do have one caller waiting and would welcome others if you'd like to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. And let's talk with our first caller on line number one in Champaign. Good morning.
Peterson Professor of Law Kaplan, as I hear you detail this Medicare plan, which I believe became effective in, what, December of 2003?
It was passed. It was passed in December.
Passed and enacted and signed by the president in 2003.
Right.
And here you detail this bizarre, complicated plan, knowing how elderly, many elderly that I'm familiar with, are risk-averse to such a complexity. Am I being unduly cynical if I were to describe this program as one that perhaps is a political shell game?
Well, that's an interesting characterization. I think you're quite right that it is complicated. And the complexity revolves around a very deep philosophical difference between the majority and minority parties. That is, this is, I think, a fairly accurate generalization that, for the most part, the Democrats are looking to give people choices of different providers, while the Republicans are seeking to provide choices of different plans. And this carries over in a variety of other contexts, but certainly in the Medicare prescription drug context, this is an example of the majority party's philosophy that there should be a variety of different plans rather than the government getting a one-size-fits-all plan, and that people can then tailor their choice to what they want. Of course, that presumes not just a degree of willingness to get in and crunch the numbers, but an ability. Much of this information is available on the Internet exclusively. The older population is the group that is the least wired right now in terms of access to the Internet. That is certainly changing, but it's also a matter of having to navigate the website and figure out what is the best program for them. But there is no doubt that there was some political, perhaps cynical calculation of trying to show older people that the administration actually addressed this problem. The problem of no prescription drug coverage in Medicare is not a new one. It was a major issue in the 2000 election and the 1996 election, and even was addressed in the 1994 midterm election. But nothing had gotten actually enacted, because there are a number of competing parties who have different points of view. And even this package, as I've described it, was not a slam dunk winner even within the Republican Party. A number of Republicans of the more conservative bent felt that Medicare is a program that's already having financial difficulties long term. The last thing you want to do is throw on another layer of entitlement. But President Bush basically called them into his office before Thanksgiving and said he wanted this done.
And is this also the case where they voted up in the House of Representatives and they were held overtime to make sure they could twist some arms to make sure this got done?
Well, that's exactly how it happened, because a number of the Republican people who felt loyal to the party and to the president nevertheless felt that this was a budget buster, that it was complicated, that older people, not all, but some would not understand it. And they actually thought there would be, if not a political backlash, at least no political benefit. And some of the survey data actually shows that. There is an article in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was yesterday, showing how some of the people who voted against the Medicare Act are actually touting that to their older constituency, and they're getting a certain resonance from that because a lot of people find it confusing, inadequate, and that this was, for some people, worse than nothing.
Well, and that leads me to my final question. As an expert in the field, and I respect you for that, would you say this is one of those cases where perhaps the cure is maybe worse than the disease?
That's a tough question, but it's a very good one, because that is, in fact, how this was presented, that this is better than nothing. And it may be, and most of the Democrats and some of the Republicans really thought that this was not better than nothing, that this was worse than nothing, that it would be better to go back, educate the population, lay out the alternatives, and come back and try to provide something that would satisfy more people. It was a political decision by the administration that this issue had simmered long enough, that they were going to try to show a certain degree of bravado by getting something enacted and then trying to talk it up, or at least make people realize that this issue had been taken off the table. There was, to some extent, even a downside, fearing that for the first time now, a single party controlled the White House and both houses of Congress. If they couldn't enact a prescription drug benefit, then what's going on? And so it seemed that that was a major motivation, and the details would just have to fall by the wayside, or they would be played out in the negotiation. I think there are very, very few people who are truly enthusiastic or satisfied with the package that emerged, and the political decision was that it was better to have something rather than nothing. But there are many people who agree with your characterization that actually this particular cure is worse than the disease.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for the call. A couple of the calls waiting. We'll go next to a listener in Pontiac on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580. Hello? Oh, my. A little difficult phone line there. I think we lost our caller. I apologize. If you would like to call back, it sounded like a cell phone that was not quite connecting with the cell. But if you would like to call back, I'll mention the phone numbers again, and anyone can use those. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana, And toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. We haven't yet talked about the cost of this Medicare program, and I also want to get into a discussion of the differing views of the presidential candidates. And, you know, I think the cost was something that was quite an issue at the time the bill was being discussed. And then, in fact, the estimate of the cost went up dramatically after it was passed. And then, to make things even more interesting, I note that, as you do in your paper on this, in April of this year, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission approved a rule that explicitly allows employers to reduce or eliminate company-provided health benefits to Medicare-eligible retirees. In other words, forcing them out of the company-provided plans and into Medicare. So that might also boost the cost of the program over time, although I guess we don't know about how many people would opt for the prescription drug benefits. One would assume it would be a number if they don't have any benefits elsewhere. So I guess the overall question is, what do we know about the cost of this?
It's a huge issue, Jack. One of the reasons that this issue continued to have interest and political traction, despite the fact that 3 out of 4 older people had some degree of prescription drug coverage, is that even those people who had prescription drug coverage felt insecure in their drug coverage. And your last point was really the most significant aspect of that, the most salient. Namely, the majority or the biggest hunk of older people with drug coverage have it from their former employer. The former employer has very little reason to continue that, and most of them have put in provisions when people retired saying that in the future things may change, we may need to raise the premiums, we may need to increase the deductibles, we may need to terminate the program entirely, and most people sign some kind of boilerplate release or waiver acknowledging that there was that possibility, even though many companies said they had never done so in the past. Well, now with the increasing cost of prescription drugs generally, they're increasing the portion of costs that are borne by their current employees and the retirees. It's an even easier target. And many companies are terminating their coverage for retirees of all medical costs, prescription drugs just being one of them. That was going on anyway. The fact that the EEOC came out with a ruling in April which said that's permissible, that it doesn't violate the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, just provides a green light to enable companies to feel they can go ahead and do that with impunity. Prior to the Medicare Act being passed, some employers may have felt, well, if we terminate this coverage, then these people have no drug coverage. Now the Medicare Act can actually provide a further impetus by employers saying, well, if we cancel our coverage, that's okay because the retiree can go and purchase this so-called Part D coverage. In fact, this issue of substitution is probably the single thorniest issue that threatened to derail the entire project. Mm-hmm. The Medicare prescription drug bills were passed in June of 2003, and the prior caller was quite correct that it got enacted in December. But from June to December, there was a lot of negotiation going on, and as early as around the first part of November, it looked like there was going to be no bill, mm-hmm. that they couldn't get over a number of the hang-ups. One was the total cost of the program, as you suggested, but the biggest single hang-up is the one that you just finished talking about, namely, will this induce employers to cancel their coverage for retirees? They're inclined to do it anyway in the face of rising health care costs. The EEOC might come out with a ruling, which in fact they did, that further gave them the green light. If there's now a Medicare substitute, there's even more of a reason to. And so they put in a provision which may not solve the problem, but at least it was an effort to move in that direction of saying to an employer, if you keep your coverage, the federal government will pay a tax credit of 28% of the cost. This is over and above the fact that those costs are deductible against the corporate income tax. Mm-hmm. So they're consciously getting a bit of a double dip. This is quite bluntly described as a drug coverage subsidy. And they further said that the subsidy itself would not be subject to tax. It is an open question whether that will be sufficient to keep employers from canceling plans for retirees. If it does, then Medicare's costs will not rise as dramatically. But notice, even to maintain existing coverage, Medicare is going to be out of pocket these 28% subsidies. That may still be a bargain compared to if Medicare has to cover these other people under Part D. But the point is, this is a grand experiment, and many people, particularly our AARP members, but not exclusively them, felt that the presence of this drug plan, inadequate though it may be, confusing though it might be for some people, is just going to be the impetus that causes employers to terminate their existing retiree health coverage. And then the EEOC ruling that came out in April just sort of added more gasoline to that fire.
Okay. We're a little past our midpoint here. We have a couple calls to talk with. We'll include them right away and also welcome others if you'd like to join us. We're talking with Richard Kaplan, professor in the College of Law at the University of Illinois, about Medicaid issues in the 2004 election, and obviously been talking a lot about the new Medicaid law that has been passed and the prescription drug benefit in particular, known as Part D of the new law. And the numbers around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have an Indiana listener next, line number 4. Good morning. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, there we go. Okay, gotcha. Okay.
Anecdotally, when this first jumped off, I went to my CVS, and the pharmacist there just gave me a very cold eye and said, I can't help you. You have to do this on your own. He says, I don't know what the hell is going on either. And somewhere along the line, I went back, and then I was explained to me, and I didn't know if this was correct or not, because I could tell he was still pretty upset, that a lot of it depends on your doctor, because if you take a card from a particular drug company, your doctor's got to make sure that those drugs are available that are on the card. And if you're taking one from another drug company, it doesn't mean anything. And I was wondering if that's actually true.
That's a very good question, and you're quite correct. That is the requirements that Medicare imposes on all of the issuers of the cards, is that they do cover a drug in a variety of widely used categories. So for hypertension, there needs to be coverage of a prescription drug, but not necessarily the one that your doctor prefers or the one that you've been taking, mm-hmm. which then puts people in a strange conundrum. Mm-hmm. Do they switch to the drug that the card covers? And what makes it a little more convoluted, of course, is that there's 73 different cards. So theoretically, one could scan the internet and find the one package that covers the drug that you want. But you're quite correct. And even if you find that, it may not be accepted at the particular CVS or other pharmacy. So you've got two sets of variables, which specific drugs are covered, because Medicare just requires that they cover at least one drug in each of several major diagnostic categories, but it may not be the drug that you're wanting to use. And then secondarily, is this card going to be accepted at a so-called participating pharmacy? So you need to get the intersection of the drugs that you're actually using and a pharmacy that is at least close enough or provides mail service or some sort of delivery so that you can use it.
Okay, and then my next question is this. Since most generic drugs are not manufactured by the major companies, where does that stand? The reason I'm asking is I have an 84-year-old aunt who, who just sort of like told me yesterday that she just can't afford any of it, so she's going to stop taking the meds, and maybe the good Lord will take care of her, and that's that. And I've argued with, it blew in my face. Then I started looking into it, and I could understand. I mean, she has, she doesn't have a computer or anything like that. I mean, it's crazy, I guess, is the best way to look at it. But I know that a lot of her drugs are generic, and I went over and talked again, and another pharmacist said, you're just, in deep water without a paddle, and good luck. And that was that. And then he started pushing the CVS card on me. That she ought to get that, and I just pulled out of it, and then started getting concerned about myself. I only take one thing, and I wouldn't qualify for anything because I don't spend enough money to, it's a generic drug, but I don't spend enough money. But I think, well, maybe later on in life, you know, all of a sudden I'll be hit with some other drugs. And then I was concerned about the following question. If you don't get into it in 2006, a particular card, does that mean you're ineligible from then on, or can you wait until things really get serious and all of a sudden you're flat on your back and you need a lot of money to help out on drugs?
Okay, well, there are a number of interesting points there. Let me just clarify one thing. In the year 2006, the drug discount cards disappear. So what happens in 2006 is whether people want to enroll in the Part D program. That's, in effect, a good thing in the sense that the whole business with the drug discount cards disappears in 15 months. It's a bad thing in the sense of, gee, if you're going to go through all this trouble to figure out which card is best for you, it seems like a lot of effort for only another a little over a year when that entire program is going to disappear. So in the year 2006, the drug discount cards are not going to be a feature of the Medicare benefit. Instead, this Part D, which will be a separate enrollment. There is a benefit to enrolling in the sense that if a person is eligible for Part D and does not enroll at that time, they will pay a penalty when they do enroll to counter the prospect that people might prefer to simply wait until they really need the coverage. That's in order, like all insurance pools, you want to get people in the insurance program who are not going to be heavy users. And since this is a $420 upfront cost, the concern is, gee, some people who don't anticipate being heavy users of pharmaceuticals might just decide to hang out for a while and then join the program later when their drug needs continue. They can do that. Unlike many private plans, they will be able to be accepted regardless of pre-existing conditions, but they will pay an additional premium in addition to the what is the monthly charge at that time. There, of course, as with any law, there are a variety of exceptions. So if they're in, for example, in an employer plan that was satisfactory and replicated much of the Medicare Part D, and that's why they chose not to become part of the Medicare Part D program initially, that's okay. They can then get into that program later without paying a penalty. But if they did not have a prescription drug coverage on 2006 or whenever they turn 65, and they simply choose to, you know, take their chances and go ahead and see what happens, and then later get into the program, they will be paying a penalty for that delay. And that penalty, by the way, continues as long as they're in the program. So that is put there intentionally to make sure that people get into the program, you might say, before they really need it, in order to spread the cost among the beneficiaries so that you don't just have the heavy users in the program.
We lost a caller there. Sorry about that. But if you want to call back, you certainly can, and others are welcome to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. I also wanted to ask you to address one point that I think a lot of people have pointed out and thought was kind of strange, that there can be no negotiation for the prices in the drugs that are offered through the program.
There are a lot of interesting and some would say strange aspects of the Medicare Act. One of them is the one you mentioned. There is an explicit prohibition by the Congress saying that the Medicare bureaucracy, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is forbidden from negotiating with the pharmaceutical companies directly for discounts. Now, that's a little different from the ban on importation, which is oftentimes characterized as an outright ban. That's not quite accurate, that if the commissioners and the FDA think that the drugs from Canada or wherever are safe, they're allowed to authorize reimportation. But this non-negotiation with the pharmaceuticals is a complete and outright ban. Under no conditions may they do that. Interestingly enough, and we're going to bring this out next week as part of the Electing Health program, but that's one of the areas of complete difference between Kerry and the Bush campaigns, that Senator Kerry, who I believe voted against this bill, says he would specifically repeal that prohibition on allowing the government to negotiate on behalf of the 38 million Medicare enrollees to get better prices. right now that is in the law that they may not do so. That is, in fact, one of the provisions that wasn't just a casual insertion or a loophole or a mistake. That was put in at the insistence of the pharmaceutical lobby and was a critical point in getting the votes of a number of congresspeople to go along with the program, that they did not want to see it happen to the pharmaceutical industry what has happened to many other healthcare providers, including physicians, hospitals, and nursing homes, where Medicare basically dictates the prices in an ever-continuing ratcheting down of reimbursement rates to the point where it can affect access and where some companies want to drop out or some hospitals want to drop out of the program. And indeed, that has happened in certain circumstances. So with that, this was not just a hypothetical fear that that Medicare would use its market power to basically dictate ever-increasingly lower prices. There's some history here of what it's done with the other aspects of the healthcare system, and there were a number of people, including the pharmaceutical lobby, that insisted that this provision be in there or else they would oppose the enactment and would lobby and would campaign against people who supported it. So this was part of the matrix of getting this strange package enacted. The previous versions over the past 10 years did not have that in there, and that's why it did not have even the tepid support that it didn't. And this is one of those things that people can find fault with all sorts of aspects of it, but each of these were there to ensure passage. Mm-hmm. It's a political question. In fact, another aspect that has become politicized of late is the Medicare Part B premium going up by $11.60. That is been a major point because this is nothing to do with a drug benefit. You can't really avoid this by saying, oh, I'll get a discount card mm-hmm. or whatever. This is everyone who's in Part B of Medicare, which is the part that pays for doctors and ambulances. And about 87% of people who are on Medicare do participate in the Part B program. And this is the largest dollar increase. It's the largest percentage increase in 1 year. It's going up by $140 a year, approximately. What is non-political is that the Bush administration really didn't have much control over that. It's calculated as being about 25% of the projected program cost. But as you pointed out, Jack, in the beginning, the Medicare is putting in more money. And they're paying more to HMOs, to preferred provider organizations. And those increased payments to managed care organizations, which was another part of the bill, are adding to the total Medicare cost, and 25% of that is being rolled back to enrollees. So that is just how the formula works. What is sort of political was that this was released about 2 or 3 weeks ago, rather than when the Medicare Part B premium is typically announced, which is the first or second week in October. The thought was that if you get it out within 3 or 4 weeks of the election, then you're going to have that firestorm. And so this is the earliest it has ever been released. Now, one of the bureaucrats claims that, well, they try to release the information as soon as it becomes available. But I believe this is the very first year that Medicare has released these cost of living increases, these new premiums, before Social Security has even announced its increases in monthly benefit payments. So this is a unique occurrence, and it's very hard to resist the idea that this was done so as to get this information out further ahead of the election.
Very good. We have just about 12 minutes left with our guest, Richard Kaplan from the University of Illinois College of Law. We're talking about the new Medicare law and also the contrast between the George Bush and John Kerry approach to Medicare and health care insurance, which we haven't really gotten into yet, but we will certainly. And also invite your calls, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. I also want to mention again the TV program next Tuesday, a week from tonight, Electing Healthcare at 7 p.m. on WILL-TV and actually public TV and radio stations all across Illinois, a 60-minute live discussion and analysis of important healthcare issues in the 2004 presidential campaign. And That program will feature representatives from the Bush and Kerry campaigns and also four analysts from the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs, the College of Law, and the College of Nursing, and Department of Economics as well, including our guest Richard Kaplan. So tune in for that. I do want to ask, now turning now to the presidential campaign and the plans articulated by the candidates, in many ways they differ dramatically, and I wonder what you would say about this particular aspect.
It's an interesting point that survey data has shown that health care is going to be a big issue in this year's campaign, though it's obviously taking a backseat to terrorism and the war in Iraq. And to some extent, it is considered part of the generic issue of economics and pocketbook kinds of worries. But within healthcare, interestingly enough, certain issues come to the fore. One that is not really resonating very much with voters is what to do about the 45 million Americans without health insurance. That's kind of fallen off the radar screen. But one that is very much on the radar screen is this Medicare prescription drug bill. That is that many people either regard it as too expensive, too confusing. They don't think it provided what they wanted. And the question is, are you going to literally, as they said about school, about integration and affirmative action, are you going to amend it or are you going to end it? And President Bush is basically taking the position that this is the best that could be gotten through the Congress, and he wants to have the program get implemented, and then if there are going to be any touch-ups, that'll come down further. But if you noticed in his presidential acceptance speech at the convention, there was not any real proposals made for Medicare. There was talk about Social Security privatization, about restructuring the tax code, but the Bush-Cheney campaign basically treats the Medicare program as resolved. That is, this is as much as they're going to do. They're not even going to try to address some of the long-term fiscal imbalances in the Medicare financing mechanism. That's just not on the radar screen, and so they're really not making many proposals. The one aspect of the Bush campaign that addresses Medicare, and this really addresses health care generally, it's not just a Medicare thing, and that's medical liability reform. The idea here is that a number of physicians are declining to treat older people because they're simultaneously being hit with increases in medical malpractice insurance and lower rates of reimbursement for the services they provide. So to the extent that medical malpractice as a crisis can be addressed and moderate their costs, and that would continue to keep more health care providers in the Medicare system. So that sort of indirect mechanism is the Bush proposal, you might say, for Medicare. Senator Kerry's campaign, according to their website, has a whole bunch of proposals. One I've already mentioned in response to your question regarding negotiating for lower prices on prescription drugs. Kerry campaign not only would repeal the prohibition, they would actually go the opposite and require the government to negotiate for lower prices on prescription drugs. They would also be more permissive about re-importing pharmaceuticals from Canada, though here it seems that the rhetoric is more permissive than the reality. Their language is basically as long as the drugs are safe and have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration, they want those Canadian pharmaceuticals to be re-imported. Well, that's basically what the existing law already is. Now, maybe their appointees would be more aggressive or would make different judgment calls about safety, but the standard would stay the same. A major change for the Medicare prescription drug benefit is that right now the plan is for private pharmacy benefit managers to actually do the implementation in 2006, with Medicare just being the ultimate funding source, but not for Medicare itself to be engaged in the process. Senator Kerry's campaign would change that and make the Medicare program itself provide the drug benefit rather than having any role for pharmacy benefit managers. If that is not going to be the case, they have a fallback position that demands that the private benefit managers disclose the profits they make and explain how they're planning to pass on the discounts that they get from the pharmaceutical companies to the senior citizens. In addition, Senator Kerry proposes to end what he calls artificial barriers to generic drug competition, which suggests some sort of revisions to the patenting process, but it's really not too clear what that would be. But the point is that the Senator Kerry's campaign regards the Medicare prescription drug bill as, you might say, a work in progress with major revisions necessary, while the President Bush's campaign regards it as more or less a done deal. Let's move on.
Okay. We have a call to talk with an Urbana listener on line number one. Good morning.
Really hard to keep in mind what I was going to say and listen to the details of what you were talking about. Let's see if I can recollect it.
Okay.
My understanding of the reason the drug companies did not lobbied hard against or lobbied hard for the prohibition against negotiating with them is that they wanted to protect their 17% profit. I don't think that they were so worried that they were going to be driven out of business. When you have a 17% profit after all the freebies you give doctors and all the advertising that they do, and the freebies are just amazing. All you have to do is be in a doctor's office and you can see all the stuff with drug companies' names on it. They have clocks, popcorn, pads, pencils, tons of stuff. The drug companies want to protect their high profits. And other countries negotiate with our drug companies for access to these drugs. Why are we paying so much more than other countries are? It seems to me we should be getting, be able to negotiate. It seems to me that this is simply a matter of congressmen caving into the lobbyists. And it also means that we're not, as consumers, we're not paying attention to the details of legislation, and we are swayed by sound bites in ads when the companies, like drug companies, go after representatives who don't vote the way that they drug companies want them to.
There are a lot of good points there. You're quite right that almost all developed countries in the world do negotiate with the same drug companies that we're talking about for discounts, and they have the marketing power to do that because they typically are universal healthcare systems, single pay kind of thing. So it's either they basically say to the pharmaceutical company, here's what we're going to pay for your drug, more or less take it or leave it. That is, we're the only buyer, and if you don't agree to this price, then you don't have access to the market at all. In many cases, in many ways, actually, the United States is paying for everyone else's ability to negotiate. That is, we are the ones that are promoting the free market and not negotiating for discounts. And the pharmaceutical companies very much feel the need to protect it for the reasons that the caller suggested, but also to make up for the losses that they are not getting, that they are incurring by having these negotiated prices in other countries. Indeed, there was a Harris survey poll that was just released showing that many Americans are not terribly convinced that lower prices would lead to less medical research because they think that the companies are spending much more than the cost of medical research on such things as profits and the drug marketing costs that the caller referred to. The various freebies are probably the smallest part of what's going on. The direct-to-consumer advertising on television, most expensively of all, is a huge cost item that's occurred in the last 5 to 6 years, where now the pharmaceutical companies are doing advertising on television, which is a relatively inefficient medium, realizing that most of the people who are going to be watching have no need for your product. But nevertheless, they're doing that as part of the marketing to drum up more of an interest in name-brand drugs. And those are huge costs, and all of these marketing costs and their profits that are necessary because other countries are basically, you might say, freeloading on the American consumer, all makes it even more incumbent on American pharmaceutical companies to protect their ability to set prices in this market.
I would challenge some of your wording. I would say if the drug companies are losing money by selling their drugs to other countries, they don't have to sell them. They're still making a profit, or they wouldn't be selling them to other countries, even at negotiated prices. They may be making less than they are here in the U.S., but if they are they wouldn't be selling them to other countries if they were losing money.
That's an interesting point, and it's worth clarifying, because this is a peculiarity. That is, the cost to actually produce an additional pill is very minimal. And so that's basically how they're pricing it, to make sure that they at least cover that cost. But when I say they're losing money, is that that's covering the cost of producing and shipping the cost, but they're not bringing in any additional money to lead to the development of new drugs. They're really just covering their basic cost of producing that additional drug that's not going to produce the wonder drugs of the future. That's their contention.
Well, you know, I keep thinking about this. We're so worried that we're not going to have the next miracle drug when so many people can't afford the medical care we already have. And when we think of, when you listen to the descriptions of how the drug company manipulates the market by changing minute aspects of a drug and not even showing that this new slight variation is any better than the older older drug. Like Nexium was one example. Lipitor was another example. Heavily marketed drugs, names that I know. I don't use either of those two drugs, but I know the names. And I couldn't tell you the name of the predecessor drug that is less expensive and that the drug companies haven't shown is any less effective. And yet, I would probably, since my cholesterol is high, I'd probably go in right now and say, how about putting me on Lipitor? I've heard that's really good. You know? And doctors don't have the information to be able to make good decisions, and neither do consumers. And I think Carrie's on the right track here in terms of changing. If he's talking about getting rid of these aspects that just change a drug slightly and allow another patent to be on this minor detail. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, I'm sorry we're out of time, and there's much more we could talk, and I'm sure that, you know, that we could address that issue more, and also we didn't get to talk about can we afford any of this in the first place, which is another huge issue, but I promise we'll come back to these issues. And also I will suggest for folks there will be another opportunity to learn a lot more about this next Tuesday evening, 7 p.m. on WILL-TV and here on AM 580 and at public radio and television stations across the state of Illinois. The program Electing Healthcare, hosted by WILL-TV's John Paul, and among the guests will be Richard Kaplan, who's been our guest during this hour. It will compare the health care proposals of the two presidential candidates, including representatives of the Bush and Kerry campaigns. They'll be part of the program, so please tune in for that. And to you, Richard Kaplan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jack.